Yes, for many, many years before the 1950s, and it started to change when Talbot Smith was appointed to the court in 1955, and George came shortly thereafter, and the two of them began dissenting. But Roger, if you go back and look at the opinions of the Michigan Supreme Court during all of the 1940s and the first 5 years of the 50s, you'll see very, very, very few dissents. Very few. And even fewer concurrences. Which meant that almost all of the decisions of the court were unanimous decisions. Well, that's manifestly nonsense. What happened was that everybody signed one another's opinions without bothering to review the records in those cases. Unless there was something in the opinion that was personally offensive, that raised a flag, a warning, you signed it and let it go. If it was internally consistent with your notion of law, whether it accurately reflected the trial or the facts ever elicited at the trial, was never really tested. I can remember another case involving Justice Carr. It was the Wingert case out of Ann Arbor. It was a case involving the rape of a blind woman, a blind student. And Justice Carr wrote the opinion in the case. And I called him up and I said, again, I'm afraid you overlook the fact that I find in the record, I find it to be of primary importance in assessing the crime. And he didn't bother listening to what I had to say. As a matter of fact, I wrote him. I didn't call him. I wrote him. And he wrote back. And he said that he had reviewed the entire record when he wrote his opinion, and he didn't find it necessary to do it again. And if I disagreed with anything he had said in his opinion, then I had better be prepared to write my own, which I proceeded to do. And never again thereafter did I engage in any discussion with Justice Carr about cases.
Now, that was the dissent on the same channel.
Yes, that's right.
I read somewhat hastily as many as I thought I could handle, and with a little bit of guidance from Frank himself. And I thought that was an extraordinary episode of difficult but extremely thorough microscopic kind of analysis.
That was a function.
Well, that's right. You took each of the psychiatrists, each of their testimony, and there was a question of the timing, if there would be an insanity. What about when the event occurred, and then how about a trial? And that's what it can be. Is that the definitive word still in Michigan on the insanity defense? Or
I really don't know. I don't get involved in such cases, and I really have not followed the issue.
Let me ask you about another case, just because it leaps to mind, and it's a one of a kind, as far as I'm aware, in recent Michigan law. That's the Cross case, where you wrote appeal, I think it was, of contempt conviction. In the holding, if I read this case, that the judge, if the injunction that he had rooted was properly issued,
improperly issued,
wasn't it not properly? I thought the burden. That's what I was going to ask you about. Why don't you say what you're holding in?
I thought
that what happened there was that the UAW had been decertified and that sort of thing. The thing was all sort of washed out. But you started out with the, not the, usual way you start out in opinion. You said this is a case of civil war over 10 years or something like that.
Yeah.
And then I thought that, well, you devoted... No, I shouldn't be dealing with this.
Roger, I don't remember the facts of the case.
Okay.
But what I do remember is that it involved the issuance of an ex-party restraining order in circumstances which I thought the law precluded. For example, there was no evidence that the regularly constituted law enforcement agencies of the state were incapable of maintaining law and order. And in those circumstances, I don't think the law of Michigan permits a judge to intrude. I think that the injunction, the restraining order that was requested on an ex parte basis, never should have been issued excepting under the most extraordinary circumstances and the strongest possible proofs, not assertions or allegations, but proofs that the local police, the state police, the governor of the state cannot maintain law. It's the only justification for permitting a court to intrude itself in controversies of that, particularly labor controversies, where you have the might of the state on one side or another, on one side or the other, either for management or against management, on the strength of an ex-party showing without absolute proof. What I wrote in that case, I hoped, would survive forever, because I think it's sound law and the only way to justify the court's role in such controversy. There was no reason in the world why the lawyers for the other side, I think the lawyers in the Cross case, the lawyers for the UAW, could not have been notified that an application is going to be made for injunctive relief. And if there had been a contested hearing, then that would have been an entirely different matter. The showing would still have to be the same. The showing would still have to establish, the proof would still have to establish that the regularly constituted law enforcement agencies were incapable of functioning without the assistance of a judicial decree, the injunctive relief.